Welcome to the Wharton FinTech Podcast. I'm your host, Zoe Tang. Today, I sat down with serial investor, VC, former Techstars exec, and so much more, John Zanoff. Previously featured on the Wharton FinTech Podcast before, John is the founder of Empire Startups, one of the largest FinTech communities of entrepreneurs, investors, bank innovators, and operators. As a FinTech legend in New York, John is back on the show to share latest updates about Empire Startup and the New York FinTech Week, which will take place on April 8th to 12th. The entire conference lineup is incredible. Check it out in the description below, and let's dive into today's episode. Hey, John, welcome back to the Wharton FinTech Podcast. Very excited to have you back on the show with us again. For our listeners, I'll link to previous episodes with John in the description. To start with, it's been a minute since we last spoke. The last time you came onto the show was 2021. It's been a while, and FinTech was on fire back then. Since that moment, public investors reappraised many of the FinTech companies in 2022 by prioritizing capital efficiency. As we just enter 2024, how do we envision the landscape evolve this year?
So, Juan, thanks for having me. Huge fan of the Wharton FinTech Podcast, huge fan of the Wharton FinTech Club. It happens to be the second best engineering school next to Lehigh in the state of Pennsylvania. But, you know, I don't hold it against you. And honestly, what Penn's been doing on the FinTech side has been super, super impressive. So, been a fan from afar. And I'm also really stoked that you and the team are going to be up at the Empire FinTech Conference in April for the second time. But you know what? I mean, this is an interesting one because I think the reappraisal of FinTech as public investors prioritize capital efficiency is like if Disney were to do a movie on the venture capital industry in 100 years, this is like the PG version of what actually happened. Or if you ever played telephone as a kid where you send one message to a friend and then they have to tell somebody else and they have to tell somebody else. Feels like the reappraisal of FinTech as public investors prioritize capital efficiency is like you lined up 100 compliance experts and made them all make what actually happened sound as vanilla as possible. But I have a reputation of saying the quiet parts out loud, and I just don't think that's what happened. I don't think the public markets disagreed with private markets. I think private markets were beset with greed and contributed to the bubble and boosted companies to unsustainable valuations. You know, at the best, it was irresponsible. And at the worst, it was violating their fiduciary responsibilities, their LPs. So, you know, it's hard to start a podcast with my friends at Wharton off so negatively, but I don't think a reappraisal of valuations in FinTech is what happened. What I think happened was too much money was being piled into private companies by VCs that were raising subsequent funds before they were willing to take markdowns on previous funds. And it created an absolutely unsustainable environment that we saw crash. So the great reappraisal is wonderful marketing. It's beautiful. I think there's a lot of brilliant thought leaders in the space. I love, for instance, what F Prime has done with their sort of public market indicators. But I don't think we're learning anything but from that assessment. I think what we're learning is there's a balance between a fiduciary responsibility to give your LPs exposure to FinTech with your responsibility to actually give them back more money. And a lot of investors from, call it 2019 to 2021, slept through that class. We'll pick on UPenn or Lehigh, same thing. They slept through that class and honestly did FinTech and founders a disservice. So yeah, I mean, a lot has changed over the last year, but you know, I feel strongly that it's important that that every investor, whether you're an angel investor, whether you're a venture capital investor, at the end of the day, you have a fiduciary responsibility to evaluate risk with a goal of returning capital, and chasing hot deals so that you could update your Twitter bio is not the way. It did not be FinTech a service. And
since we're talking about this already, how do you anticipate the broader macroeconomic environment will further influence and shape the FinTech sector? As you talked about the last couple of years, there are a lot of capital flowed onto the private side. Now seems there's a little bit more cool down as people are switching their gears or focus towards AI. So how do you think changes, you know, in the landscape in terms of investors' focus or like broader macroeconomic environment will influence the development of FinTech going forward?
Yeah, I know when we when we caught up last week, you know, talked a little bit about the fundamentals of fintech or the macro environment and fintech and how it affects it. I mean, my first answer is that at pre-seed and seed, these truly aren't factors I'm spending a lot of time considering. You know, there were plenty of quote unquote experts on Twitter talking about ZIRP over the years and its effect. And I can't talk about that. And I do believe that it will cyclically affect opportunities in fintech. But at the end of the day, pre-seed and seed, you're investing in a team, you're investing in people, you're investing in people that you think can outperform, you're investing in people that have a beautiful chip on their shoulder to do whatever it takes to say, you know what, I could go make 10x working for JP Morgan or Goldman, and instead I'm going to change the world. And that's where you're placing your bets. And I specifically say placing your bets versus underwriting risk, because at the end of the day, these are very low probability potential outcomes, but at the end of the day, when they do come through, they can return a fund. But anyway, to you know, go back to your question, fundamentals in fintech, you talk about mainly, I would think, demand. Is there demand for digitized solutions? And I think absolutely. You know, another question is, you know, how far are we along in fintech? And I loathe the early innings analogy. So if any of the listeners of this podcast have a better analogy for me, DM me and you'll be my best friend for life. But the way that I tend to think about where we are in the trajectory of adoption is, if the financial product was originated by a digital means, it's really difficult to say, okay, the underwriting was done in a highly technical manner, or this loan was papered in a highly technical manner. But what you can track is whether the origination of the sale of a financial product was digital in nature. And in that context, we're, you know, we're sub 20% across almost every financial product, across a vertical, whether it be remittance, whether it be loans, insurance products, depository accounts being, you know, the most digitized, you're really talking about the adoption of digital solutions in the, call it the sub 20%. And that means there's still, you know, tremendous growth opportunities. You know, the other fundamental is, and I spoke earlier about greed in venture capital and how venture capital and entrepreneurship aren't aligned at all times. But the other important note is just access to capital. And that's also as strong as ever. There's arguably more capital available to fintech companies now than there was previously, simply because venture capitalists now are slowing down. When you're not sure what a typical seed round, what a standard valuation, and we can talk about standard valuations, but what a standard valuation of a seed round, if you're not sure, you're simply extending diligence longer. You're looking for those comps. You know, talk about reappraisal. It's like you're buying a house and you look at the three comps around. That's what investors are doing. They don't want to be the price maker. They don't want to be the one out there putting their neck out on the line saying, I think the fair, you know, fintech seed valuation should be 12 million. And long story short, that means there's a lot of capital out there. I mean, other fundamentals, a regulatory environment. We talked about demand for consumers, but there's also demand from financial services on the B2B side. I think that's probably an overlooked aspect of or fundamental in terms of demand. I think banks, insurance companies, asset managers are as hungry as they've ever been for new technologies, which is good. I'd say the regulatory environment is the only area that I say is lukewarm. I haven't found anyone impressed with the last two administrations' positioning on fintech and financial services. Disappointed in the CFPB's notes on 1033. You know, just underwhelmed kind of across the board. So I don't think the regulatory environment in the US is going to be, you know, especially helpful for fintech. But, you know, New York is the fintech capital of the world in spite of regulators, not because of them. So it'll sort of be business as usual. And on the macroeconomic side, you know, listen, you're talking to an engineer, you're not talking to an econ major. And so, Zoe, I'd rather hear your thesis on sort of macroeconomic trends. But, you know, the only thing that I would say is these are cyclical. And when you're talking about a 7 to 10 year time horizon to see if a seed investment is going to work out, chances are you're going to see both sides of that cycle. You're going to see a high interest rate environment. You're going to see a low interest rate environment. I don't particularly think, I'm not looking at certain products or certain sub verticals, I'd call them, within fintech because of a, you know, extended period of high interest or low interest rate. I think the interesting thing we saw with the pandemic, and you've had many folks talk about this on your show, is when the market is down and or people have extra time on their hands, they tend to reevaluate their partners. And I think that was a really healthy thing that happened for financial services and fintech. Folks were, you know, on their couch for call it a year of the pandemic, receiving 0% on their depository accounts in a choppy stock market, and were reevaluating their entire portfolio. And I think that's just a really, really healthy process and something that, you know, healthy that came out of, I'd say, both the pandemic and the bubble. But again, those aren't trends that I would develop a thesis around to invest in. It's just interesting at the seeds.
That's a really comprehensive view of the fintech landscape. So it's super helpful. I agree with you. I think there's a lot of interesting data out there saying like the fundamentals for fintech is still strong, regardless of the micro environment, especially like if you look at like over the last 10 years, the fintech percentage of revenue is only like single decimal percentage compared to incumbents. So some think like there's still a lot of, even if you look at from like a, if it's a zero sum game, there is a lot of opportunities out there for fintech companies to take over existing incumbents revenue, to your point about like digitization. But I think you gave a really helpful kind of like your perspective to kind of enrich how I think about things.
I appreciate it. I mean, to state the, you know, bit of the obvious, a lot of fintech products are not the profit centers for banks. It's about cross-selling. It's about nurturing that customer throughout their lifetime into financial products that end up delivering more profit for the bank. It just happens to be some of those products are going to be the last to be digitized. Those are the big spends. Those are big mortgages. Those are big investments. Those are large insurance products. They tend to be the last to be digitized. And that's the point of venture capital, is to provide small, potential, competitive, future category killers with the capital they need so that they can just break even as they acquire customers, as they build trust in the market, and then eventually they're able to cross-sell to the wildly profitable products like health insurance or life insurance that banks just mint cash by selling.
Yep, for sure. And then I think based on like what you talked about, like a broader fintech ecosystem, last time when you were on the show, you shared your thesis on YOLO fintech. Can you share a bit more specific areas nowadays you're passionate about? You talked about digitization, you talked about B2B fintech, which are all like great areas that a lot of investors are focusing on, but like just wondering specifically any interesting themes or like companies you're particularly passionate about these days.
Yeah, and I stepped back, I had a little fun with YOLO fintech my last time on the show, and YOLO fintech was a fun way to sort of brand it. But at the end of the day, the concept was consumers are leaping into financial products like they've never done before. You walk by a new gelato shop on the Penn campus and you say, heck, I'm going to try this today, whatever, I deserve it. You only live once, I'm just going to try it. And that desire and appetite, proclivity to adopt a financial product has just never been seen before. You know, 50 years ago, no one was like, I really want to try this new mortgage. Like, what the heck? I heard it's cool. And that's a new phenomenon. And that's changing the dynamics of CAC, LTV, and I guess you could say churn. And I say that because, you know, Zoe Tang probably has 14 different fintech products in her wallet at any given time, because you appreciate the experience and you want to learn and you have that appetite. And that's never happened before. And what that means is for those 14 companies, they acquired you for significantly less than sort of historical norms to acquire financial customers. But at the same time, you're a zombie account for many of them, or you're churning. And so the phenomenon, the YOLO phenomenon, I wouldn't, maybe not call it a thesis, but it's important to note that CAC to LTV, especially on the consumer side, is just wildly different over the last 5 years than it had been the previous 50 years. Now, granted, the 50 years, no one was focused on SEM and SEO maybe 50 years ago, but the point stands that consumers today are just willing to try a financial product because, you know, word of mouth, they heard it was cool. They like the branding. They like the weight of the card. They like the Super Bowl ad. That's really a fascinating new trend to sort of evaluate and get behind. You know, your question on what I'm excited about, insurance is a really interesting space to me. I think most insurtechs and insurance companies can say, you know what, the average American from a financial wellness standpoint and globally, but we'll just talk about America, the average American is underinsured. The average American doesn't either know enough or have the financial wherewithal to buy insurance products that they should to protect them. And, you know, create an umbrella in a storm, if you're to use that metaphor. But the reality of digitized insurance products is that They're embedded at the point of sale. They're a tick box that no one understands. They don't understand the terms of. They don't understand. They don't price shop. They don't know if this is the best deal. They don't know what this deal covers. And so, you know, at the end of the day, right now, these are just affiliate marketing programs designed to make more money for insurance companies and in no way are in the best interest of consumers. But I do think, thanks to new technologies, and again, I know you have plenty of experts on LLMs, but the opportunity here from an education standpoint is pretty powerful. New technology, new conversational AI technologies are going to have the ability to educate consumers in complex financial products that they previously would not have understood, and therefore can both lower friction to consuming and buying those products, but at the same time, educating users. So embedded insurance is a fascinating space. If you look at whether it's the origination of insurtech products as a gauge of how much room there is to grow in the space for fintech and insurtech as one metric, as you look at the profitability of the titans in Boston, all of these say that there's just tremendous opportunity to bring, you know, new technologies to insurtech, both on the embedded side, which is really about consumers and educating consumers, building trust and having consumers understand that, no, this product, just because there's a tick box, this product is meant for me and I should be buying it. But also on the underwriting side, it's insurance especially, you might have digitized origination, but the underwriting process is wildly laborious, especially on the life side. Could take 30 days to underwrite a whole life policy these days. So spending a bit of time in insurtech, as you can kind of imagine, I think that's an easy one for the next, you know, not just next decade, next 20, 30 years, continue to see innovation in and around the space.
I definitely agree with you. Over the last 5 years, somehow I think a lot of fintech companies are able to make financial products more sexier, like compared to like your traditional brick and mortar.
Do you use a fintech for your deposit, for your checking account or savings account, or are you using a more traditional company?
I'm more a traditional company.
That's okay. Banking, I'm not out of you.
I'm banking with the Odin Grand, you know, JP Morgan Chase.
But yeah, you know what? Chase is, I mean, the team at Chase is brilliant. I think this narrative that traditional financial services, one, don't have, you know, their customers are unhappy with them simply isn't true. You look at, you know, my friends at Cornerstone and the NPS surveys they have, like folks are wildly satisfied with their American Express card or their Chase checking account. That sort of narrative of, you know, fintechs coming to destroy the bank is something largely brought out by the media, and it simply isn't there. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm pretty sure JP Morgan Chase is spending more on fintech than just about anyone in the world. So, I mean, you're in good hands there. Just always curious what other fintech nerds are using.
Yeah, I think they are really quick in terms of adoption from your perspective. You know, whether it comes like digitization of the banking experience or open banking, like partnership with fintech companies like Plaid. So I think that's kind of the challenge with fintech sometimes as well, is like you as a startup founder had this really great idea, but then incumbents just have so much more like resources or capability to quickly kind of try to replicate your core features or functionality.
Yeah, my theories are like slightly different in that this goes beyond fintech. And because I've worked at the largest asset managers, investment banks in the world, and I've worked at, you know, three-person startups. I worked at, you know, solo GP, solo startup, if you will. At the end of the day, small companies, their advantage is twofold. One is communication. When everyone's sitting around a co-working desk and everyone's singing from the same hymn sheet, it's just communication. Everyone's lockstep. If I was working for a large asset manager, which I've had, I'd say 50% of my time was only spent evangelizing what we're working on to other groups. And so everyone's 50% as efficient, regardless of the culture, oh, big stodgy bank. It's simply as you reach a certain scale in a company, your job becomes communication and not actually operating. And so, you know, regardless of whether it's fintech or something else, I think small companies just will absolutely always ship product faster. It is not because they have better engineers, because they don't. I'm sorry. The best engineers I've ever met were within financial services, not within fintech. No shade. But they're simply, one, they're not positioned to move fast or communicate fast just because of their size. And then the other thing just comes down to compensation. Folks, we're just using JP Morgan because you mentioned you bank with them, but folks at JP Morgan are not paid to take chances. they're not paid for their failures. Whereas in fintech, you have to throw as much spaghetti against the wall as humanly possible and see what sticks. And you just don't have that luxury as an incumbent. And that's just not changing anytime soon. But anyway, I think the biggest sort of misconception is that folks aren't happy with JPMorgan Chase because the product suite is pretty special.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree with you. I think a lot of surveys, they say like people are not happy with their existing banks, but they're still sticking to it. A lot of times people are trying to compare it to like a tech product, which is, I think like we still have a long, long way to go. And then there are a lot of like ways fintech can help that as well. It's just like the experience is just not completely there yet. But to your point, like because of the product suites or because of the other offerings incumbents are able to offer, it's just really different for our customers to get a more convenience from existing players like, you know, JPMorgan Chase. And then I know like you are very involved in the fintech ecosystem and particularly in for New York. Since you kind of launched Empire Startups, there are a lot of other fintech focused like communities now emerging in New York. Just wondering, what have you been up to? How do you see yourself and then Empire Startup or the fintech conference provide most value to the fintech founders?
Yeah, I started the fintech meetup in New York in 2010, and that was just a wildly different time. The friend Matt Burton most recently at QED had pulled up some numbers, and you know, just Google search interest in fintech was flatlined. And then from say 2012 to 2020, just absolute hockey stick growth. So a bit of luck. I mean, back then though, it was really a wonderful community. I mean, the community is great now, strong in numbers, strong in just awareness and being part of pop culture. I mean, I don't think there's been a Super Bowl without a fintech ad in the last 5 years, which is mind-boggling. But in 2010, it was much different because it was just all folks, all just, you know, beautiful nerds that, you know, were happy to collaborate. And they finally sort of found other people that were super passionate about what they're doing. You know, when everything becomes fintech, what we run into in a part of startups is occasionally somebody is at an event or attending a round table because their boss told them they have to. And so you've lost some of like the love of the game as everything has become fintech. And that's just a personal answer, Zoe, to, you know, to be honest. To give you sort of a more maybe traditional answer is, you know, in 2010, there was nowhere to turn. If you were thinking about leaving your job, if you were coming out of Wharton thinking, should you go to fintech versus this offer you have from, you know, Barclays, the meetup was the place to go. But now not only is, you know, every day in New York City, there's a different fintech event or a fintech meetup, you even have individual generations. There's a Gen Z community, there's a millennial community, the Gen Xers, and call like the boomers and breaking banks. You sort of have each generation creating their own community and collaborating, which I think is really powerful. To answer your question about what we're focused on, you know, as the need for to get, again, my fellow nerds in the room every month in a meetup and hear from a founder or venture capitalist is less impactful. But what is more impactful and the way that we think of ourselves today is simply as a platform in service of the entire ecosystem. And what I mean by a platform is we raise awareness about every job, every event, every round of funding, and let others around the community use our channels to raise awareness. And Fintech Week is a perfect example. Fintech Week isn't about Empire Startups events. Fintech Week is about events from 50 different organizers that don't have to pay. There's no paywall involved because we're purely a community organization to raise awareness and drive just the next generation of innovation within fintech. So maybe a sappy answer for you, admittedly, Zoe, but you know, the shift from this need to assemble the community every single month to now that we're 100,000 plus fintech enthusiasts to just use everything we built in the community to raise all boats and spread the good word about all the interesting things happening across the ecosystem.
Yeah, I was talking with Rex Salisbury from Cambrian and then also Nick from This Week in Fintech. They share a lot of like similar perspective as well. They're saying like community building is very much evolving product because at the end of the day, you want to service the people in the community. From your perspective, as the community gets bigger, to your point, there are a lot of subcategories as well. And then sometimes it's harder to engage people in the community. Like what are some of the effective ways you see like keep people engaged or like keep people wanting to like come out or like meeting other people and like exchange opportunities in the specific area?
Yeah, I mean, we've known Nick and the Twift team for some time and are fairly mission aligned in sort of the service of community. What I think a lot of folks will throw around, and even listeners throw around, you know, this desire to be active, in the, whether they are active or not, they might have a desire to be active in the community. And there's generally two types of people that want to be active in the community or want to be quote unquote community builders. One is the folks that are looking to build their personal brand. And that's completely fine. You might be coming from a different industry, maybe an expat. You might have just relocated. Whatever reason, you're simply looking to extend connections and contacts and build your own personal brand. That's fantastic. It's hugely important for everyone to be considering that early. And then you have other folks that simply want to see, and this is where I think more of, say, Nick and I are aligned. You simply want to see innovation. You simply are pulling for the underdog. You simply know that if we could play a small role in creating financial wellness for billions of folks around the world, I think that's really powerful. And I think it's really powerful to say being a founder is the loneliest and hardest thing. And just to simply make it a little bit easier and be in service of those founders who are the folks in the arena, I think that's super empowering. But you know, to answer your question about advice for folks in a fairly noisy community, I think the first is just being open and honest with yourself about why you want to be a community leader in the first place. Are you building a personal brand? Do you need a megaphone to monetize some other or for go to market or for some other business? Or, you know, do you truly just believe in innovation and engineering and building product and want to see these things happen? And I think if you're open and honest with yourself, that'll kind of dictate the direction that you may want to go. But listen, Empire Startups is still a fantastic place to start. You know, even for, you know, college students, we end up bringing 30, 40, 50 volunteers in, you know, every single year and can give anyone exposure to just the who's who of fintech. So interesting feedback that maybe some people with so much noise in the community don't know where to go. But I think one, knowing why you want to build community, and then two, just hit empirestartups.com is a great way to start.
Got it. I know you invest in the ecosystem, as you said, and you wanted to uncover innovation in the system. Do you feel like just being in the Empire Startups and then actually organizing these opportunities help you filter for the best innovation? And then how does that really help you to do that? Because I feel like a community, like community builder like you, will make founders feel more comfortable sharing more information, probably compared to like a VC that they know, like kind of like are there for the founding opportunities. So how do you see like Empire Startup help you like filter for investment opportunities for yourself?
Yeah, well, companies that have presented at Empire Startups have gone on to raise over $10 billion. Actually, let me phrase it differently. Companies that have presented at Empire at the seed stage have gone on to raise over $10 billion. So at the end of the day, the opportunity to, you know, nurture and work and support pre-seed founders and then be positioned right when they look for capital has never been more important. And so, you know, absolutely Empire Startups helps with that. I think the other aspect, and this isn't just a fintech thing, but it is always venture-backed companies, it's always about the story. Every MBA thinks it's about the market opportunity. Everyone thinks it's about the sort of defensibility of the technology. And these are important factors. But at the end of the day, the most important thing for founders to focus on is how they're articulating their story. And that's to attract investors, that's to attract employees, that's to attract customers. And so the work in Empire Startups, and also you may know I ran the fintech program for Techstars for a number of years, you know, between the two, without exaggeration, easily 30,000 pitches between the two. And pattern matching is a bit of a buzz these days, but you start to meet founders that can truly evangelize their mission and their vision and get people behind them and get people excited. And that is an absolute critical factor in making an investment decision. So simply being, you know, comparing that to an emerging fund that is hunting, maybe, you know, has to attend conferences in order to see demos and in order to see pitches. It's just night and day in terms of just the sheer volume of pre-seed fintech founders that I'm fortunate enough to interact with on a daily basis.
Yep. And then speaking of, you know, interacting with fintech founders, the New York Fintech Week will be back again on April 8th. I'm super excited for it. Just wondering, like, if you can share some highlights that you are excited about with our listeners as well.
Yeah, we're expecting, I mean, one thing about Fintech Week, biggest thing people are always confused about is, hey, can we host our own event? The answer is absolutely. It's entirely free. Head to empirestartups.com, click on the Fintech Week button, and there's information on hosting your own event. It is truly a collaboration of the entire ecosystem. You mentioned Twift. Twift will certainly be there hosting one of their happy hours. But partners like Barclays, Flourish Ventures will be in town. Anthemis will be doing their event, Tusk Ventures. So every, you know, the investors, the card networks like MasterCard will be hosting things, big tech companies like Amazon and IBM. So it truly brings the entire ecosystem together. One thing and that folks tend to be concerned about is just, you know, how many events is too many. Last year, all 42 events were sold out. We're expecting more than 50 this year. So one is to grab your tickets early. And if you're thinking about doing an event, absolutely. Things we're excited about, we'd like to involve some of our culture, meaning Empire Startups culture in the week. So we're doing a couple fun things this year. One, the opening party is a boat cruise. I never thought I would rent a 3-story yacht before, but here we are. We're doing a cruise around the city to kick off the week. And then we have, I'm not sure that yachts are my culture, but by the way, but what is our team's culture is we love comedy. So there's a new comedy, FinTech Comedy Night on Thursday. So the TLDR there is it's not just about, you know, nerding out on core technologies, which is a huge part of FinTech Week. It's also about creating bonds, getting to know partners, supporting everyone around with sort of a slew of events. The other really interesting thing that I love and flourishes as the mastermind behind this, but whether you're working in tech, whether you're a founder, whether you're just an operator employee in tech, it's very challenging. You're always behind. You're always chasing incumbents. You're always not shipping as fast. And so mental health and wellness is just a huge part and should be part of every conversation around entrepreneurship. And Flourish is doing a half day wellness pop-up during FinTech Week, which really speaks to their values of leaving the world a better place, but it's pretty special. So a ton to look forward to April 8th to the 12th. Early bird tickets for the Empire FinTech Conference on the 10th are on sale right now. I'm sure we can add a 15% off promo code for our friends listening to the Wharton podcast as well.
Thank you. I'm sure they'll appreciate that. Like for those of you who haven't gone, it is really like the fashion week of FinTech. When I went last year, there's like so many exciting things going on at the same time. I just feel like my calendar is probably like triple booked all the time.
I love it.
Yeah, and
I was going to the Super Bowl of FinTech, but fashion week of FinTech, I love it. One, because I don't like sports metaphors. Two, I just love that. Can it be the unfashion week of FinTech?
It's just fascinating events of, you know, breakfast or happy hours or like even cool events like, you know, go on to a yacht, a cool boat. Let's just put it that way since you're not into the yacht culture.
I'm just saying, even though it's a yacht, it's going to be a bunch of hoodies on the yacht. I'm just saying, there's no Versace at any FinTech Week event.
Yes. And then, yeah, it's just amazing to meet so many people coming like from all over the country, even from the world. Sometimes I meet some international founders.
Well, Zoe, you're a little FinTech famous thanks to your work on the Wharton Pod. So don't be surprised if some people are pretty excited to meet you as well.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Thank you so much again, John, for taking the time. It's really been a pleasure sitting down with you again.
All right. Thank you, Zoe. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Wharton FinTech Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review and give us a follow on social media. We appreciate the support and hope that you'll continue to spread the word to more listeners. If you like to keep up with all the content from our FinTech community, please subscribe to our podcast channel and find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Medium at Wharton FinTech, where we'll be able to find articles, interviews, and much more analyzing all aspects of the FinTech industry. As always, thank you to our editor, Raffle Austria. And until next time, this is your host, Zoe.